the article sort of is just a compilation and a summary of all of the learnings that we've had in terms of how can you look at outcomes and progress and impact for societal issues. So when your work isn't so concrete and success is not so easy to define the way it may be in other sectors, how do you then assess progress? And we essentially put out the way we look at it. And it is an invitation to others to sort of bring their own frameworks in, bring their own thinking, so that we can as a sector start to talk about societal impact a little bit more deeply.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to maximize their impact. Because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Beredovitz, founder of Spring Impact. In the last episode of our special series with Stanford Social Innovation Review, or SSIR, we're exploring the complex nature of impact measurement. Our guest is Natasha Joshi, Associate Director at Rohini Nalkani Philanthropies. In her article, Plotting Impact Beyond Simple Metrics, Natasha encourages philanthropies to move away from a single metric approach when evaluating their grantees. Instead, she offers a variety of ways to look at impact. Today, Natasha explains why foundations should place more trust on the organizations they fund, especially when dealing with complex problems. We discuss different impact metrics and how these interact with one another. On the show, Natasha also tells us why the role of philanthropy shouldn't be to solve problems, but rather to enable others to do so.
I've worked in the development sector for about 12 years now, and I did my master's in education, which is where my journey began. And I studied abroad, but then I came back to India and I essentially started working in the field of public education. Then I sort of moved from the state to the center. So I worked with a central planning commission in India where it was a lot more about public policy. And from there, I transitioned into grant making, which is what I currently do. I was with a separate organization, again, looking specifically at education. But for the last couple of years, I have been here at this philanthropy, which is a private family philanthropy.
Rohini Nalkani Philanthropies focuses their investments on several areas, including conservation and climate, gender empowerment, and access to justice.
We, as a philanthropy, give a lot of untied multi-year grants. And essentially, our principal, Rohini, had done several interviews in the global arena on trust-based giving and how her sort of method for making grants is much more based on trust. And I think that some of the conversations that emerged on the sidelines from trust-based giving, and I think some of it was also covered in SSIR, this sense that, you know, trust-based is one way and then, you know, outcomes-based is the other way. So I felt that there was this false dichotomy between, you know, trust and outcomes. And so it was being perceived that, you know, if you give on the basis of trust, then you're not very outcomes-focused. And I think there was an interest in trying to unpack that because we don't see the conflict between trust and that. I think that whether or not you measure the relationship or the viability of a particular grant or the decision to make a grant to an organization, whether you base it on metric A, metric B, on an indicator, on a log frame, on qualitative reports, on relationships, those I think are your tools for evaluating the work and making meaning. But trust, I think, should be non-negotiable across. You should be trusting your partners irrespective. So that's a hygiene factor, and everyone should aspire to that. And then how you measure, how you track, how you engage, how frequently you do, organizations can decide what suits them.
Problem solving isn't always linear, especially when dealing with complex social issues. That's why Natasha believes that foundations must place more trust on their grantees.
There is this consternation amongst field-based organizations and social change leaders that there is a lot of scrutiny and micromanagement of grants. And grants can become very watertight. The reporting processes can become very onerous. There isn't very much room for experimentation or even dynamically responding to a situation. So, you know, a grant written up a year ago for XYZ even if the field realities have changed, you still have to do X, Y, Z because there isn't a recognition. And the people who are most proximate to the problem aren't able to sort of re-engineer this grant. You know, so it is people sitting very far away from the problem who have decided that X, Y, Z needs to be done. I think also there is this, perhaps I don't know, like anxiety or a sense of control also, where it's one thing to say that there is a lack of trust, but there's also this assumption that, you know, you can draw straight lines between inputs and outcomes, that society is not in flux, that things are not reflexive, you know, things are linear. And I think that's another challenge, you know, which whether or not you trust somebody, if your thinking is that, you know, A leads to B, B leads to C. I mean, what we have found in the field is that's just simply not true. Things are a lot more circular or cyclical. Things are a lot more reflexive. Things change, they're dynamic. So what we need is process, you know, any kind of interactive process that lets you iterate.
Looking to investigate further, Natasha and her team conducted a survey with about 80 of the organizations they fund.
One of the things that at the philanthropy we always do is that we are very grantee-led, and grantees are our partners, the people we make grants to. And so instead of saying, what do we think about impact and outcomes, we actually asked our entire network of organizations how they would articulate their impact. There were essentially just, I think, two questions. If you had to describe your own impact, whatever you think success is, how would you describe that? So, and they gave us a lot of both numerical as well as qualitative inputs. And the second question was, how should we as a philanthropy define success for ourselves? What do you think is the impact of philanthropy and how should we measure it? And we got all these responses. And then we spent a good amount of time reading every single response. And as a team, we did a triangulation exercise where a teammate of mine wrote his understanding of what was emerging. And once we did that, this framework started to emerge. And what came up was that essentially, organizations were reporting in terms of this is what was successful or this is what was progress. They were reporting four key items. One was concrete actions, very clearly. You know, we distributed X fashion kits in this financial year. We provided legal aid to X number of people. You know, we resolved these many grievances online. The second thing that they reported was around who they worked with in getting this done. So collaborations, whether they partnered with different organizations, how they expanded the reach of their work, how they were able to do programmatic handshakes where, you know, they did some stuff and somebody else did some stuff, and how those collaborations enabled some of this. The third piece was, of course, on engagement. A lot of people said that how they tried to kind of force multiply a lot of the offline efforts with online initiatives, how they produced research to try to sort of get more traction. And then there were metrics around that. We got these many hits and these many downloads and these many comments and so on and so forth. And finally, there were some organizations who do focus on policy change that reported tangible policy modifications that had happened as a result of their inputs or where they were in the process of providing inputs on policy.
Natasha plugged these impact metrics, concrete actions, collaborations, engagement, and policy change into a quadrant. She then divided them into tangible or intangible, slow or fast emerging. Next, Natasha explains the logic behind the graph. You can also follow the link in our show notes to see it.
Concrete actions and things like engagement were very quick metrics. You know, they were emerging very fast. You know, you would do something and then you would get the results pretty quickly and it was tangible and you could report it. On the other hand, you had things like collaborations and policy change that took much longer. You know, there were longer arcs on that work. So that became one continuum, you know, fast emerging versus slow emerging. So what can be seen really quickly and what takes time? The second axis is essentially tangible versus intangible. So what is it that's evident and visible versus what is in the waters, what is underneath, what pertains to either values or mindsets or even behaviors and how some of that has changed. And a lot of that was reported qualitatively. And that's what the article also opens with, because one of our partners talked to us saying that, you know, while they increased livelihoods and while they, you know, provided X and Y to the community, when they asked the community, what do you think our value has been? The first thing that the community said was, you have taken our fear away. And there's no way to, you know, there's no way to measure that.
Yeah, highly intangible. Yeah.
Highly intangible, but highly valuable, you know, to the entire community that experienced that relief. Now, every time we are in conversation, also we realize that most often organizations are actually doing kind of all of the four. And therefore, even when you're looking at the impact of a program or an org's work, it's really useful to look at all of the dimensions of their work to get a sense of how they are creating coherence within the system. And, you know, the article sort of is just a compilation and a summary of all of the learnings that we've had in terms of how can you look at outcomes and progress and impact for essentially societal issues. So when your work isn't so concrete and success and is not so easy to define the way it may be in other sectors, how do you then assess progress? So I think that is the core intention, and we essentially put out the way we look at it. And it is an invitation to others to sort of bring their own frameworks in, bring their own thinking, so that we can as a sector start to talk about societal impact a little bit more deeply. Of course, it depends, but it also not just on the domain of work, but I think it also depends on how we see the linkages between each of these areas. And I think that it's very difficult to advocate for policy change without having a lab, without having kind of any sort of field upon which things are being tried and interventions are being tested. So I think concrete actions are absolutely vital. So I would say that's definitely non-negotiable. You have to have something you've put out into the universe against which, you know, your own understanding and progress is measured. I think if I could answer this a little bit differently, Dan, I would say that there are organizations that are not able to sort of look at the larger system, and they sort of just look at very proximate, deep actions, but, you know, perhaps don't have the bandwidth or for various reasons, aren't able to zoom out and look at the system within which they are located and then how to entangle that. At the same time, I think there is this counter sort of pressure on organizations to scale. So scale beyond their current geography, scale beyond their scope, and sort of go system-wide. So if I had to say that what is the pathway to scale for a lot of organizations, some of the examples that we have seen which are really powerful are the ones that have used collaboration as a pathway to scale rather than replication or, you know, building a much larger organization.
And maybe you can give us an example of some of the most concerning things you saw when you were researching or looking at the metrics. Maybe it's incorrect assumptions. Yeah, what were some things that were not working?
So one thing I will say that was curious in our data set as well, not so much as not working, but it's not very clear whether it is working, yet everybody's doing it. So things like online engagement, you know, there is this sense that everybody must have a newsletter, everybody must have a social media handle, everybody must have, you know, ABC. But it's not very clear that if you get 20,000 likes, what happens after that, you know, especially for the kinds of work that one is looking to drive. You know? So if you're trying to work on gender-based violence and you put out an ad campaign and then the ad campaign gets lots of eyeballs, that's good. And people have reported that as success. But one also has to look at the amount of effort and time it goes into doing a very successful and high-quality campaign vis-a-vis where the funnel goes with the eyeballs to volunteering, to action, and so on and so forth. And I'm just saying that I think we don't have enough understanding yet of what good and thick engagement looks like. I think we do need to unpack engagement a lot more, given that it seems also to be the direction where everybody's trying to put in more time and energy.
I asked Natasha where random control trials fit into her way of thinking. RCTs are studies that use experimental and control groups. They're considered by some the gold standard of impact evidence.
I think there's a lot of commentary now on the limitations of RCTs, and them being extremely expensive is comes right at the bottom in terms of the challenges. They're very, very expensive to do, but I think they are also limited in terms of what they're able to surface in terms of causalities and many other things. We're supportive of any of the partner organizations doing it. That is what they think is going to help their understanding. But I think we do recognize the limitations of RCTs and We tend to favor a much more mixed methods kind of approach, which looks at some amount of data, but also looks at a lot of qualitative research. And it has a little bit more longitudinality to it and a lot more context.
I wonder what your reflections are on how organizations have changed over time, because there's been a conversation about systems change maybe that's emerged seriously in the past only maybe 4 or 5 years. Of course, there was thinking before that, but sort of when we're talking about the sector overall, do you think organizations were doing less of this complex, you know, engaging, collaborating, policy, concrete, all the four things previously, and that the space is changing and becoming more complex, and that's why this is sort of framework is needed now?
I might disagree. I think that organizations were always working like this. I think that the way their impact was being talked about and the way they were having to fundraise was a bit different. If you look at it very long back, it was much more relational. Your donors, they were your supporters and they were your lifetime supporters. You know, you had a lot of organizations, definitely in India, where there were, you know, old families that supported any kind of program for years. It wasn't a sort of, I'm going to give it to you for 3 years. It was just, we believe in this cause and we're going to give you money on an annual basis. The landscape definitely shifted both globally, and then there were a few different reasons why it shifted in India. I think the landscape, of course, shifted with a lot of multilateral and aid organizations, right? IMF, World Bank, the entire UN, trying to sort of create some sort of sense of where their aid money was going and how it was resulting in change. In India, simultaneously, we had a liberalization period where we went from a closed economy to an open economy. And when that happened, the government of India became very interested in working with nonprofits because they were the last mile organizations and they had really deep connects. So that looked like an opportunity for a lot of nonprofits as well for scale, because suddenly, you know, you could actually effect change through a very large government machinery. But, you know, naturally relationships with government meant that things had to be a lot more concrete and there was some distancing between the trust and, you know, and the work. So I think this has been a series of factors that has led to the way organizations have to communicate their impact versus, I don't think it has necessarily changed what they do. They've always operated in gray. A lot of field organizations have always contended with the gray. I think that now they feel a lot more frustrated because they're not able to convey that necessarily.
In the survey, grantees were also asked how they thought philanthropy should define success. From their responses, it became clear that the role of philanthropy shouldn't be to solve problems. Rather, it should be to enable organizations on the ground to do so.
Philanthropy should hold itself accountable to. The question is, what should it hold itself accountable to? Should we hold ourselves accountable to the problems that we care about? So to what extent are the macro indicators and the things we care about moving? And our understanding is that that's a real leap because we're many degrees removed from that kind of change. And also, I mean, I think we operate with some degree of humility around our own abilities and our own role. So we say that perhaps, you know, it's hard to track that kind of macro change. We realize that looking at what programs are achieving is not necessarily the role of philanthropy. When we asked our partners that how should we measure our impact, one of the interesting things was some things were just universal and they came from almost every partner. And that was essentially saying, nurture organizations, you know, set us up for success. Make sure that we're able to be sustainable, essentially keep supporting us, so keep giving us oxygen. So it was a lot around seed the space with more organizations, but also really kind of help organizations grow and develop. So it's not so much about programs, but it's much more about can you really develop and nurture organizations? And I think that's a really important point because that does get lost, you know, when we look at problem statements, when we say that, okay, if we want to solve hunger, if we want to solve violence, you don't look at developing organizations that can then eventually have the capability to do it. You just see that, are we solving that problem and not so much, are we just creating organizations that will eventually figure it out.
So the one way I've seen it quite helpful to look at that is, are we buying outcomes i.e. just funding whatever the outcome we want, you know, children to be fed, or are we building organizations who have the ability to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. The reason why I think it's really important to build organizations, one is that they can respond much more dynamically to problem statements that keep shape-shifting. So, you know, and who is going to understand how the shape has shifted better than the people who are really on the front line? If we're trying to say that our area of work or our field of work is children's education, for instance, then we're assuming that children's education or education is a fixed concept and that its definition and its own parameters are not going to change as time changes. You realize that what education even means, and whichever education is relevant to the needs of children who have to then inhabit a society which is radically changing, that whole thing means different. So you can't say that, you know, we're going to essentially solve the problem of education, because the problem will continue to mutate. So then what you say is that what you can do is you can essentially build up organizations that have the ability to respond to the changing needs of the environment. And that is essentially resilience, right? Resilience is the ability of individuals, organizations, and systems to respond to change. And so therefore, shouldn't the metric be, how are we funding resilience? What, you know, our desired outcome is resilience. It's not education. It's not clean water. Our desired outcome is resilience when it comes to the access to clean water. You know, the resilience of societies to respond to all of the things they care about. And the resilience of organizations that are then working on these problems. And they will continue to iterate.
By sharing the findings and analysis of her survey, Natasha hopes to spark conversations around improved ways of measuring impact.
So one thing has already happened. I had a conversation with somebody at CoImpact, and, you know, on the lines of this article, and they mentioned that they're also looking to really understand, you know, how to assess and measure grants that they make, because they also look at a very kind of trust-based approach, but they also look at a systems change approach. And so we're actually doing a sort of online gathering of people interested in this question of, you know, how do we look at progress on wicked problems, and how do we, as funders, create the conditions for organizations to better sort of address and tackle these problems? I think if there are funders and philanthropies thinking about this, yes, please invite us into those spaces so we can learn and or please get in touch with us that we could share more about what we're doing. So that's, I think, conversation is really what's needed right now, and various different stages of conversation. For practitioner organizations, I think definitely if there are some very innovative and useful and deep ways in which they have been looking at their own work, I think there should be some platform and some way for them to be able to share some of that. So I think that just having more spaces and creating more room and opportunities to share would be really lovely.
I appreciate how Natasha acknowledges the complexity of measuring social progress. I hope that today's conversation encouraged you to reflect on how you might be limited in the way you evaluate impact, and to think about what you could do more. If you want to learn more about what we discussed today, please visit ssir.org to read Natasha's article, Plotting Impact Beyond Simple Metrics. And of course, you'll find many other fascinating articles in there too. A link to purchase the magazine is in our show notes. Before we go, we'd like to thank SSIR for the work that they do and for partnering with us in this series. That's it for our special series. If you missed previous episodes, we urge you to catch up and listen back to the incredible stories and practical insights from the SSIR authors. And if you love Mission to Scale, please recommend our show to a friend or colleague. You can subscribe or follow our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thank you so much for supporting our podcast, and we can't wait to catch you all in the new year for another season. In the meantime, happy holidays. Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter.